Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, Bluegrass, American Roots, and more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X.
For a dream ocean, turn a tender eyes to me. Stingers in the ocean, sweeter than any honey. But you blinded me with science.
She blinded me with science.
Good morning, welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms. And we do tend to play some rather cool music as well. You've got Julian Pauly Lamb in the studio as usual. We'll be talking to our PG shortly. We've also got a guest speaker this week and indeed every first Saturday of the month. It's Phil Muffett from the Mexburton Swinton Astronomical Society. All being well. He'll be talking about their Solar Sunday event last week at RSPB Oldmoor. He might even be talking about noctilucent clouds, the strawberry moon we had and Super Puff Planet. Let's hope he's done his homework, eh? In the science news this week, though, it's all about nature. First up, the long-awaited government estate nature plan has been published, setting out how government land will be used to boost nature recovery and resilience. Some £4.1 million has been pledged to test new pilot projects, including on army land and prison grounds.
Next, salmon farms face being stripped of their organic status over growing environmental and welfare concerns. The Soil Association, the charity which certifies British organic salmon farms on behalf of the government, will decide in October whether to walk away from the sector or stay to drive up standards. It has become increasingly frustrated with high fish mortality rates, environmental pollution and unsustainable feeding practices.
And foxtail grasses are becoming a growing summer threat to Britain's pets, vets have warned. After seeds of these common grasses dry out, they stick to animal coats and can bury deep into their skin. So if you Google that, foxtail grasses, be aware of it. They can get in pets' ears and things like that. So finally, on a general roundup.
Yes. A zebra has been born at Bridlington Animal Park. I didn't know Bridlington had it.
It's a very small park, I think.
And it's called Zuri, Z-U-R-I, which is Swahili for beautiful. The Grant zebra, which is the smallest of the seven subspecies of plains zebra, is classified as near threatened on the IUCN, which is International Union for Conservation of Nature, red list of threatened species. These are usually found living in Central and Southern Africa in countries such as Kenya, Tanzania and Zambia. Zuri is currently living in a large field at the park with access to a stable.
Oh. And still talk about nature, there's a brilliant article in the press the other week to do with Chris Packham. I think the main article was about the green parakeets. But he took this opportunity to also remind us there's a lot of other birds in Britain that he believes are misunderstood. So that, and I thought this was really interesting. So magpies, he says, you only find magpies where there are sufficient songbirds to support them. And that's because their diet includes eggs, baby birds and fledglings. The smart birds, he says, once they find food, they focus on it. It's easy if you've got a garden to think that the magpies are destroying the bird population. But he says all the science actually lets them off on that point. It's all about the ecosystem. And his other one is crows. He says with the equivalent intelligence to a three-year-old child, can you believe, crows are smart. We see them solving problems, so we tend to be suspicious of them. They are generalists, can live everywhere, eat anything. And in a time when specialist species are in decline, generalists like the crows will increase. And he says that's just ecology. Another one, it might make you think twice about the feral pigeon that many really don't like. Pigeons, he says, were domesticated from rock doves, a cliff-living species on the west coast of Scotland and Ireland. When we build multi-story buildings, pigeons see it as the habitat they originated in. They eat anything, turn all that food, as we know, turn all that food into crop milk, and feed their young by regurgitating extremely fat-rich milk. And that means pigeons can breed in any month of the year. Hence why there's so many of them. Another interesting one he talks about is swans. He says it's a crazy myth that swans have the capacity to break a man's arm. Birds' bones are hollow. They need to be light enough to fly. So swans fly, so their bones are strong but hollow, and they're not strong enough to break an arm. Don't go and try that out for real, because I think they can be quite aggressive nonetheless. Wow. And the final, like, gulls. Chris Packham says when people talk about gulls, normally they mean the herring gull. And this is an amber listed species, which means it's in decline. So it's on the danger list. The herring gull eats human food. So it's drawn to large waste sites where we dump lots of food. And on that point, it says we're still wasting a third of the food that we produce. And he said on the coast, herring gulls have declined for reasons of industrial fishing and pollutants. So the gulls have adapted to exploit us back, and seemingly we are resentful of that. So I thought that was cracking, that. Misunderstood birds. So think twice when you look at a magpie, a crow, a feral pigeon, indeed a swan, or even the herring gulls that are nicking your chips. Great track there. Birdland by Quincy Jones, done in 1989. I presume that's a cover of Weather Report, is it?
Yeah, I would think so, yeah.
And why do we play that? Because we're talking about Chris Packham's article on Britain's misunderstood birds. Think twice about the birds you see around you. Of course, you're listening to the Live Sounds Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We're every Saturday morning, 11 till 12, talking about science in all its different forms. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Bit cooler this morning, a bit of respite before the next looming heat wave.
Yes, yeah, you rush out and do all those jobs in the garden without fainting now.
Exactly. Now we're shivering now because we've come slightly acclimatised.
Can't win, can we?
Yeah, no. We can't at all. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then, Paul?
On the local front, something about... I don't know how you kind of developed an interest in things scientific, but one of the main things for me was going into the library. And there's a study by Sheffield University into what's happening with the England's public library collections. And they say that they're in danger of being hollowed out. And said that they're facing a quiet hollowing out, according to a major new study from the university, and saying that physical library collections have shrunk, the spend per person's fallen, even as the borrowing levels have held steady, that means libraries are being asked to do more with less. So nearly half of library services cut their physical stock budgets in 24-25, with an average reduction of almost £19,000. And more than 85% of library services surveyed spent less than 86p per person on new physical book stock in 24-25. So digital licensing costs are rising and competing for the same shrinking budgets with libraries. So they're locked into this inflexible, expensive model. And they say that it's been commissioned by the Combined Regions and conducted by Sheffield University, gathering data from 36 public library services across England and a consultation with industry stakeholders. And it says it paints a picture of the sector demonstrating resilience under serious structural pressure, but one increasingly stretched beyond sustainable limits. So in the age of Google, libraries are still sort of providing a service, but like a lot of places, they're being squeezed on cost. So I think that's an interesting sort of piece. There's actually a much longer, more detailed piece that you can get to on the University of Sheffield site, under news, and that came out on the 27th of June. So another sad look at what's happening with books, I guess.
I know there's a big national push, or there has been, to get people reading again, particularly young children, but everybody, and just to get you off your phone and actually concentrate on something that you've to concentrate on. You just can't keep swiping.
Well, the problem is literacy, and what they're finding with a lot of young people now is They've developed sort of computer and social media speak, which means that they can't really hold proper conversations with people.
And it's grammatics as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. So it's a sad thing, and I think it's one of those things. I know my local library is now run by volunteers, and I think they've just shrunk down to three opening days a week. And I think that even Central Library has been sort of under wraps with lots of hoardings and things for quite a while. So, and there's always talk about the future of Central Library because the building's crumbling and he's going to need a lot of maintenance. Mm-hmm. So, a sad bit of news, that one, but this is a science programme, so I thought we'd have something a bit more exciting. And there's going to be a rescue mission in space. Actually, a mission to rescue a telescope called the Swift Observatory, and it's in danger of falling out of orbit. So it was launched back in 2004, so it's been going for 20 years, and they're saying that what's happened is the solar activity has been shifting the Earth's atmosphere, aura, which has really sort of extended it out to come onto the edge of the orbit of the telescope. And what that's done is to slow it down a little bit, which has gradually whittled away at its orbit. So it's started out at an altitude of 373 miles, that's about 600 kilometres, but now it's gradually come down to 220 miles, and they was in real danger of actually falling out of orbit. So NASA looked at the problem and said, oh, really, it's got to be worth saving. It's done tremendous work. I mean, it was put into orbit to look at really super high energy events in space, like exploding stars. It's captured some great sort of material doing that study. And I think Dr. Simeon Barber of the Open University said that because it's falling due to the Earth's atmosphere being pushed out due to the solar activity, then it slows the orbit and reduces that. So it was in danger in the next year of getting beyond redemption. So the people at NASA got in touch with a US company called Catalyst Space Technologies. They're from Flagstaff in Arizona. And what they've done in the space of less than a year is to create a new satellite, a robotic satellite with three arms that's going to be launched into space. And it's actually been launched into space already. It's on its way to try and first it's going to do a little orbit around the telescope because of after 20 years of being in orbit, people on Earth are saying things may have changed on the actual telescope, that there have been some instances that could have changed its configuration. So it's going to slowly spin around that telescope, taking detailed pictures, sending them back to Earth, and then they're going to try and guide this capture satellite, which is called Link. And that's going to slowly move into close into the telescope, try and attach itself with the three robotic arms, and then it's got some low-level thrusters as part of the package, and it will slowly push the satellite, the telescope, using the satellite thrusters to take it back to its as close as they can get to its original orbit, to possibly give it another 20 years on if the circumstances remain the same. but it's what it says that if it fails, then people are going to miss out studying the powerful explosions in the universe, and that's the things like the violent death of giant stars and the colliding embers that are left behind. And the energy released in that kind of thing is that equivalent to that the sun will give out in its 10 billion year expected lifetime.
Wow.
Massive happenings out in space, and so far away. So again, satellites take you out of a level of pollution. And now we've talked about the swarms of satellites that have been put into close space orbit. They're between the Earth and the things that they want to observe. So these telescopes, we've had Hubble telescope had to have a rescue mission because of a problem with the design on its mirrors. And what they're seeing is that it's worth keeping these things away from Earth, close orbit, so we can study distant events in space. So an exciting rescue mission underway to try and make sure that that telescope comes back. They launched it on a Pegasus XL rocket to get it up close, and now it's going through the manoeuvres to inspect SWIFT, and then hopes to grab and boost it slowly back to its orbit. So I thought that's an interesting one. And just a sort of comparator, down on Earth, we've just had the first images generated, I think, on the 23rd of June from a new telescope that's Earthbound. It's called the Vera C. Rubin, and it's in Chile in the high Atacama Desert, which is a very clear sky for observing as much as you can do from Earth. And this is a powerful new design of telescope, and it's a unique three-mirror design. And sort of getting some idea of how it works, light enters the front of the telescope and hits its primary mirror, and that's 8.4 metres diameter. So about length of a double-decker bus wide. So that hits that first. It's reflected to a secondary mirror, which is a mere 3.4 metres. So one story high, I guess, is that, which then bounces it back to a third mirror, which is 4.8 metres diameter. And from there it goes into a camera that's been specifically designed and built. And it's the world's most powerful camera. It's a 3,200 megapixel camera. And by comparison, they give you some nice data, which says that that's equal to 67 times megapixel capability of an iPhone 16 Pro.
Wow.
So it's it says, if you wanted to view one of the images created by this, you'd need to put it out onto 400 Ultra HD TV screens to view a single image.
Wow.
Hey,
there's some money in this lot, isn't there, Paul, as well?
Oh, absolutely. And you say, well, yeah, what's the point? The point with this is that it could see some of the incoming things like meteors that may be threatening the Earth from a greater distance than we've had. So it's going to do that. But again, our understanding of the universe, this is going to feed data out to, they think, something like 10 million scientists around the world.
Hmm.
So basically, they're going to study this thing, and what they were saying with the setup with the cameras is even a speck of dust on the cameras could affect the actual findings from this setup. So it's there, it's running its tests, it had its first images out, and it all seems to be quite prepared and ready. But I think with this idea in space now, a lot of it is to see distant parts of the universe. We're seeing events occurring which are thousands of light years away. So we're actually looking into time and space, which we've dabbled with the ideas of before, but some tremendous work going on to either save things that were already created or to create a new super standard for quality of observations from Earth. And the good thing about them is that they can see for miles.
Oh, very clever, Paul. Does the article say who funded them? Is it?
It's a mix. NASA's put a lot of money in. The Americans also designed and built the camera system that's in use. Again, on the rescue mission, that's a NASA-backed rescue mission. Just looking at the actual finance involved, they think that it's worth rescuing rather than have it fall out of orbit and have to recreate it and put it back in position.
Blimey.
Big money, big resources, but we're back in a big space race.
Indeed. I can see for miles by The Who. What a great track you've chosen, Paul.
Well, it'd be nice, I think, just to sit and listen to that now.
Sit back and enjoy. It might be appearing on Glory Days Rock Show one day. Ooh. Well, it already has, I'm sure, but we'll play it again, I think. And we'll speak to you Monday as well, Paul.
Thank you, Paul.
Bye-bye. Yeah. Bye.
Okay. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I know you deceive me, now here's a surprise. I know that you have, cause there's magic in my eyes. I can see for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles. Oh yeah. If you think that I don't know about the little tricks you play and never see you when deliberately you put things in my way, well, here's a poke at you. You're gonna choke on it too. You're gonna lose that smile because all the while I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles and miles. Advantage of my trust in you when I was so far away. I saw you holding lots of other guys, and now you've got the nerve to say that you still want me. Well, that says maybe, but you gotta stand trial, because all the while I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and I know you've deceived me, now here's a surprise. I know that you have, cause there's magic in my eyes.
can see for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles. Oh yeah. The Eiffel Tower and the Taj Mahal might be on clear days. You thought that I would need a crystal ball to see right through the haze. Well, here's a poke at you, you're gonna choke on it too. You're gonna need that smile, because all the while I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles and miles and miles and
The Who there with I Can See For Miles, because RPG was talking about the rest of you missing in space to do with the Swiss Observatory, but also the new Vera C. Rubin telescope. All exciting Ooh. Stuff. He's treading on Larfield's toes there, I reckon. Anyway, you all listen to the Live Science Radio Show. You're on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have Phil Muffett on the line. Good morning, Phil. Good morning. Oh, hang on a minute. Where is he?
Hello.
Oh, he's back. Is he's it? Back. It might be our connection. Good morning, Phil. Oh.
Oh.
Oh, hello, hello. Good morning. Are you there, Phil? We seem to have lost him. It could be our connection at this end. We should be talking to Phil Muffett, of course. I might have to try and ring him again. You'll have to play some music, Paul. You'll have to ad-lib. This is live, of course.
Back, telling lies like she does. Living for energy is the one in the dark. Never know when she'll strike. Got a foot on my throat. I can barely breathe. She's the eye in the sky. Stabs you from behind. She's the devil. You know she'll hang you around to dry. When she grins and she looks deep into your eyes. When she drinks, when she smokes, she'll save her nights in school. She's the eye in the sky that stabs you from behind. She's the devil.
And we'll try again. Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. It is live and things do go wrong sometimes. All being well, Phil, we can hear you now. Yes! You see, it's never fun if it all goes right, is it?
Live programming.
Live Ooh. Programming. And where are you, Phil? You're on
Numbers Car Park.
Excellent. And on that note, to start off with, even though you are obviously, we're going to talk about astronomy because you are a member of the Mexican Swinton Astronomical Society, but you're also a member of Manvers Waterfront Boat Club.
Yeah.
And tell us about the lake temperature. I did mention it briefly last week, but there's been further Yeah. Further news.
So all these people that are dismissing climate change, I can well and definitely tell you that it is on the increase. So this year, it's been above average temperatures for the first half of the year. The lake is 6 degrees above the average temperature it should be. And the other week, when we had the heat wave, 35 degrees, the lake got up to 25.2 degrees, which is hotter than when we had the heat wave where we hit 40 degrees.
Whoa.
So we had slightly less temperature, but we had it for a longer period of time. So it still raised the water temperature up. So we've got a new lake temperature record, and this has been going on for about at least 10 years now.
Amazing.
So with all the records you look at, it's constantly now above the average, what it should be. And it was 6 degrees above average. In fact, it's 6 degrees. It's 22 degrees today. So it should be about 15 or 16 degrees.
But it's been warmed, hasn't it? It holds its heat. I mean, I remember it from sailing. The sea in the spring is relatively cool, but by September, October, autumn time, it's had a whole summer warming, and it holds the heat, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah.
So if you've got stuff living in Manvers Lake, like fish and stuff, it's going to start to impact on that, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly is. Yes, and we've got four terrapins, turtles in the lake that I think they bred last year. We've got a mum and a dad, and we noticed last year we got two additional small terrapins that sit on a log in the lake. So they've bred in the past year or two. I don't know if they've had any more babies. We've not seen.
Amazing.
Them.
I always think of terrapins as somebody would have them indoors in nice warm water. Yeah. So tells you
these are as big as fruit bowls, dinner plate kind of size.
Good
well,
grief.
The big one is. Yeah. It's quite interesting to see them. I don't think it's affected any of the other wildlife. I'm not sure what they're eating, but it's an interesting spectacle. People keep photographing them.
Yeah, but as the water warms, it does change, you know, the ecosystem, doesn't it? What can survive? Yeah, we've seen that all over.
And the catfish have bred in the lake, because we've got more than one now. And the last time I saw it, a couple of Christmases ago, it's about 5 feet long.
it's like a Loch Ness monster, isn't it?
Yep. Manvers. And the thing is, the warmer the water is, the more ideally suited it is for catfish to grow bigger and bigger and bigger. I think it's a Wells catfish.
They don't eat meat, do they? You know, if you fall in.
They eat chicks, and they eat coots and ducks. I actually think we saw one. A coot disappear last week.
Oh dear!
From the surface of the water.
Oh.
So, and people swimming here. So I think it needs to get a bit bigger before it start taking people.
Eating people. You could have You could have spring watch from Manvers, couldn't you? Quite easily.
Well, there's a nature reserve next door.
Of course there is.
So we do get quite a bit of wildlife from there coming over, and we've had a heron moving this year. In fact, it's tried building a nest on the lake this year.
Tried.
Which has not happened before. We've got a kingfisher, which is really, really
But hard. That's it's just amazing. And you're in that area as well, sailing and swimming and paddleboarding and all that, you know.
Yes.
Interesting. Yes. And on that note then, talking about nature reserves, you had Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society had an event at RSPB Old Moor last Sunday.
Yeah, there were some nice photographs. So people go and have a look around around the lake, and also have a look through the telescopes. So we have an array of telescopes to look at the sun in different frequencies, so you can see different colours and different layers of the sun, hydrogen, visual and calcium wavelengths, and it looks different. If you go on our webpage, if you go on our Facebook page, you'll be able to see some photos.
Excellent. Did you get a lot of people interested?
There were quite a few people came through, and we had three new faces in the club room on Thursday night.
Oh!
So that was interesting.
So these new people who signed up and joined your club?
Well, I think they've come and, they've only been once, so yeah, hopefully they'll come back.
Oh, you've not frightened them away then?
Not yet.
Great. Interesting. So, I suppose you do have these public outreach events, and as you say, you know, if you're an astronomer and you're doing it on your own, it's not quite as much fun as being in a club and sharing it all.
Share. It's like I've been doing photography for the past few years. I've been using my iPhone. I've moved on to proper cameras now. But I've been able to do what I'm doing at the moment, taking photographs of deep space objects that are really, really faint. And I've come on so much in the past 2 years, and it's thanks to people like Tony Morris, who's our curator of instruments at the Observatory. He's done photography ever since he was young, and he's taught me so much in a short period of time. And to be honest, if I was doing it on my own, it'd be a lot longer learning.
Yeah, because you've all got your different individual skills, and you can share that knowledge, and you can say, well, I've been trying to do this, it hasn't worked, and somebody can say, saves you hours and hours of scratching your head.
It does, yeah. I'm watching the right YouTube videos as well. YouTube videos. There's some really good photographers. It's amazing. There's a guy in Canada that lives in the outback, and he's a brilliant photographer, and he's got a really good YouTube page, and he's been explaining different photo techniques, how to do stuff, and I picked up some cracking tips off him. I actually made a comment on one of his photographs, and he actually wrote back to me and said, it's nice to know my YouTube videos have made a difference. And I'm in an urban environment with street lighting, and he's in a wilderness where it's like dark.
Yeah.
It works. Yeah, it's really good.
I'm sure he knew who you were, Phil.
Probably, but you never know.
You never know. You should have said, I'll send you one of my T-shirts. But on the talk of public outreach events, you did tell me this, but your club's at Wentworth Village tomorrow, is it?
There's a Garden of Fate. So it starts at 11 o'clock in the morning and it finishes at 4 in the afternoon. So we'll have a stall there, a little marquee, and we'll have some telescopes on display so people can look at the sun, hopefully, when it's out between the clouds. And we'll have an array of instruments so you'll be able to see the sun at different wavelengths, and hopefully we should have some wow factor.
Wow. Because you've done that a few years now, haven't you, on the trot, doing that?
Yeah. I don't think it was very successful last year because I think the weather was bad.
Yes.
I think it even rained last year, I think.
Yeah, how unkind. But that's all the part of being an astronomer, isn't it?
Yeah.
Nature.
And of course, the other thing is we've got proper filters and equipment so you can actually look at the sun.
Safely. That's the key, isn't it? Yeah. So when we talk about your ever-improving photography, lots of things we could talk about then, because you've been photographing noctilucent clouds.
Yeah, so last week, I've not seen any for the best part of a year. I've been keeping an eye out. Anyway, I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday last week, we had an exceptionally clear night. And I know it's exceptional because when I look due south, I can actually see over the fence. I can see down to the horizon, which is looking south over London. Now, if I can't see any clouds on the horizon, I know the atmosphere is really, really clear. So I got my equipment out about 11 o'clock. It took me an hour to get it all working. Now, one of the things is, it's been that warm, the camera's heated up. Now, the really good photographers are using cooled cameras. Now, what they do is they cool the chip down to below zero and they take darker pictures. Now, I don't mean the stars are darker, the background's darker. Now, when I set up last week, the camera was 30 degrees because it's got a sensor inside of it. And I could not align the camera, well, the telescope, because the pixels in the camera were too warm. And basically, the stars and the hot pixels couldn't differentiate on the software.
Blimey.
So it couldn't work out where it was looking. It took me, after 12 o'clock, it took me over an hour before the camera cooled down to 26 degrees, and I'm outside in my bare feet, in my shorts, with a T-shirt on. And finally, it actually locked on Polaris, worked out where it was looking, and then it started to work. Anyway, I took an image of, I think it was a dumbbell nebula, and when it came through on my telephone, the background, there was lots and lots of green pixels, and there were green pixels because the chips were hot and the pixels were glowing. So I kind of got the picture but it was nowhere near what you'd expect, and it's purely because the electronics were too warm. So people get or produce a ZWO to a camera that's got a fan and a coolant inside of it, and it cools the camera down to whatever temperature, and to be honest, near zero is probably the best. So even if it's warm, you can still do photography. So I've worked out now, if it's too hot, it's a waste of time taking deep sky photographs.
Well, who'd have thought that?
Yeah, well, it's something I've learned, and wow, something else I've just learned. So anyway, was it Monday? Again, it was exceptionally clear. It was cooler. Anyway, I got my camera out, and I managed to take a couple of brilliant photographs. I got the Veil Nebula and 652 Cygni, which is basically a supernova that exploded about 15,000 years ago. And it's been expanding and expanding ever since. I think the nebula's about 6 light years in diameter, and it's like carbon, oxygen and sulfur, and it glows at a specific colour, and the camera picks it up. So, and it looks just like a veil. It looks like a really, really faint, flimsy veil, and it kind of intertwines and twists. And it's a spectacular thing to see. I've once seen it visually at Todmorden in Lancashire when we did the star party back in the 1980s, and we had a massive Dobsonian telescope, like 18 inches in diameter, and you could just see it near the star 52 Cygni because it illuminates the nebula. So yeah, it's taken me all this time to actually get a photograph of it.
Wow, is that because your equipment now is so technologically advanced compared to that telescope back then?
Last year, I managed to photograph it with a DSLR camera, the Canon D60, but I could only manage an 8-second photo before the streetlights overwhelm the chip. And you could just get a hint that it was there, but you couldn't actually really see it. But these new ZWO cameras, they're designed to look at a frequency where you can pick up these gases and clouds. So, yeah, it's my photography is a vast improvement on last year.
But this thing about the temperature...
Yeah,
you know, we talk about, you know, an ever warmer climate, you know, we haven't got air conditioning and our infrastructure's just not designed for it. Who'd have thought telescopes and cameras and pixels and would be affected? Because I certainly wouldn't.
Well, I would have thought so. It never occurred to me. I know cooled cameras are better for taking faint photographs because you need to, the cooler the chip is, the less energy it gives off. So the cameras are designed to pick up light energy. So any other electrons buzzing about in the system, it kind of interferes with your picture. So the cooler it is, the better it is. But I didn't imagine 30 degrees would stop
would make it like that. And that's in stark contrast to during winter when you were saying you were outside and it was so cold. The equipment won't work, so you've got two extremes there.
That's when you need an observatory to keep the fresh
air. And you're building one, aren't you, Phil?
I'm building one.
Have you built it? Have you finished?
I'm up to my roof.
Brilliant.
It might take me a couple of months to build a dome, but I've got to waterproof it. I'm going to resin fiberglass the roof.
The trouble is, it'll be even warmer in there.
Well, I've put some insulation in the roof.
Oh, clever. And
the other thing is, what people also do is stick fans in them and coolants so they can blow cooler air out.
So does this mean you won't have to buy a ZWO camera then? That's
Well, it'd be nice to have one.
Oh, yeah, it's on the Christmas list, is it?
I just need a windfall. Might be on the Christmas
list. With any hobby, it's always, what I really need is this. It's not that you want it, Phil, you need it to improve, improvement.
I'm gradually working through all the equipment to get better and better.
Brilliant, I love it.
It's good stuff, and it's all a big learning curve. And of course, the other thing is you can rub this off on other people as well.
So,
but when you talk to, when you see these photographs that people are producing, in fact, there's the C Star has a Facebook page and people post stuff on it. And when you look at some of the Sea Star photographs, and it's only a 50mm objective lens, some of the photographs are absolutely mind-blowing. And you'd think they'd be taken from a massive observatory. And it's getting harder and harder to tell how big people's telescopes are.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the quality is filtering down to amateur equipment.
Yeah.
So I've got a 3-inch telescope. I've also got an 8-inch reflector. I've not started using the 8-inch reflector with the new camera gear. I'm waiting while I finish my observatory, and then I'm going to install it inside and then set it up with the gear so it's permanently all wired.
Permanently,
up.
Yeah.
That means I can go outside, turn it on and use it without spending an hour or half an hour getting all my gear prepared, getting it all lined up. I mean, it might take me 10 minutes to get me telescope polar aligned.
Are you going to put a sort of beer fridge in there as well then? Because you don't want to lose time having to go into house and fridge, do you, Phil?
No,
get a little cool box, little one of mini fridges.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
A few snacks.
You've got to be careful. Might have snacks, yeah. There might be a few incidents about drinking and using expensive equipment.
Using expensive equipment. But you know what you say about your telescopes and stuff? It's just like mobile phones. If memories come up on Facebook, Seth, and 15 years ago where friends have taken a picture, the quality of that photograph is nowhere near the quality of photographs that we're getting now. They're much more granular.
They are. In fact, you probably lose... When you repost photographs, you're probably losing some of the detail on the
Oh, yeah. Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, some of the photos we're taking, some of the cameras are like 10 megapixels, and you can't get all them 10 megapixels on an iPhone because the picture's too small.
Ah. Uh-huh.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You can't. So some of the pictures, if I put it on my laptop or a monitor, The pictures are so much better on the laptop because it's filling the screen with the pixels.
Yeah.
When you squeeze it down onto a 2-inch by 3-inch screen on your iPhone, it's like you lose something.
Mm,
you can't see the same detail.
So when you were talking about what you photographed early this week when it was really, really clear skies, you photographed the noctilucent clouds as well? Or is that what you were talking about?
Yes. Yeah. So after I'd done my half-hour photographs, I noticed that the sun, the sky was getting light. Anyway, when I looked, I thought, I think it was quarter to three in the morning.
On a school night. Phil.
I'm paying for it now. I've still got an headache. So when I looked over to the northern horizon, I realised it wasn't just the sun. It was the light reflecting off the noctilucent clouds. So it must have been about 2 o'clock in the morning it started forming. And then as the sun's below the horizon, it's coming up to the horizon, the light's bouncing on the underside of the clouds and it's lighting the sky up. So to be honest, at 2:45, I had to stop photography because the sky was starting to get too light.
You're not a vampire, are you, Phil?
No.
You're going to bed before the sun comes up.
Yeah.
Grief.
I used to have the nickname Cinderella because when it got to about 12 o'clock, I always used to, if we were doing any observing, I would say, I'm going home now, I'm going. Because I'd have to go to bed to get some sleep.
Yeah.
To work.
Yeah.
So, but some other lads were a bit more robust than me or didn't have serious jobs and then stopped.
Oh. I keep telling you, you need to retire, Phil, because you can't fit it all in.
I'm getting there.
You're burning the candle at both ends, aren't you?
I've only got 4 years to go, don't worry.
4 years and counting. Tell us what noctilucent clouds are then. Are they rare?
They tend to be a summer apparition, and it's moisture and particles right on the edge of the atmosphere that are really cold and the kind of form that ice crystals and vapour. So because it's high up in the atmosphere, the sun's actually shining. Have you ever seen when you get a sunset and suddenly the clouds light up from underneath?
Yes.
Well, it's the same kind of thing. The sun's underneath the clouds, shining up round from the other side of the world and bouncing back down. Now, they're not red because they're that high up. They're above all the all the pollution and the atmosphere. Whereas when you get a sunset normally and the sun's low down and the clouds are low down, because the sun's going through a thick part of the atmosphere, the light beam that is, it refracts the light to the red end of the spectrum, so the white clouds start to look red. But the noctilucent clouds are really high up and they tend to look white because wow. you've not got the same amount of atmosphere, the bright on the edge of the atmosphere, so it's more of a true colour.
Wow.
But anyway, it's an interesting phenomenon to see. And it can brighten the sky considerably.
So you managed to photograph that. Is that something you've photographed before? Or is that just by accident?
I've had odd photographs of noctilucent clouds before. And Mick Nichols in Sheffield, he got some nice photographs of noctilucent clouds as well. And I've seen some from down south London area where some people have photographed it as well. So, yeah, it was quite phenomenal. I think that was it on Wednesday or was it?
I can't remember because I know there was a it's all been happening because there was a strawberry moon, I think, on Monday as well.
Now then, the strawberry moon, there was a swim at Manvers as well on the strawberry moon. They've started swimming on a full moon. So one of the reasons, somebody said on Facebook that it was because it's when the strawberries ripen in June in America. But I think there's a more scientific thing to go with it. When you get a strawberry moon in June, it is the moon's in the bottom part of the ecliptic, which is in Sagittarius and Scorpius. So what I'm saying is the moon's really, really low to the horizon. Now, when you get light low to the horizon, the atmosphere bends or it refracts the light beams to the red end of the spectrum. So where the moon would normally be white, because it's that low to the horizon when it's full, you're seeing the red light, not the white light. So
wow.
It's got a red tinge to it. So that's a real reason they call it a strawberry moon, because it's got a reddish tinge to the actual moon.
God, you know, you're so clever, aren't you, you? You know, you said to me, you came on.
Years.
I know, you said you came on. You said, I've got no notes, I'm going to have to wing this. But you just know it, don't you? Because you've been doing it for so long.
Yeah, you can't.
Amazing. No, you're brilliant, Phil. We always said you ought to have your own show. You more or less have. You're on here all the time. You're on here more
fantastic.
Than anybody. Eh?
Well, it certainly sharpens your mind. When you
but it's great because you're sharing your knowledge, aren't you?
Yeah.
You
know, I just thought people listening can actually take something home from this.
I learn from it.
Apply it themselves.
Learn it. Because you think you're just talking about astronomy, but you're not. It's all science, isn't it? The different gases and what the sun's doing, reflecting.
It's science. Yeah.
It is science in all its different forms. On that note, Phil, sadly, we're going to have to let you go because we've only got 2 minutes left.
Brilliant. See you next month.
Yeah, brilliant, Phil. Bye bye. Thank you. Bye.
To meet your shower next month.
Oh, is there? Yeah. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Like she does, living for it. And she is the one in the dark. You'll never know when she'll strike. Got a foot on my throat. I can barely breathe. She's the eye in the sky. Stabs you from behind. She looks deep into your eyes. When she drinks, when she smokes, she'll save her nights in school. She's the eye in the sky that stabs you.